Save big at Banana Republic Factory with 60% off the entire store. Our biggest sale of the year. Plus, take an extra 50% off clearance. Stock up on dresses, shirts, and shorts under $15. Find your nearest store or shop online only at Banana Republic Factory.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rusland, this week we have, who do I go with first? BFM's very own Umba Pagan Umpke Parker.
Hello, Cam.
And for now, anyway, BFM's very own Lee Chui Lin.
Hello.
But Lin is leaving BFM.
I don't know why we have to make a big deal about this, Cam.
It's a big deal.
It's not
That's
a big
why.
Deal.
I'm not making a big deal. It's
you are. It's, your face is making a big deal.
It's just reality. You're leaving BFM. So this is your last episode of A Bit of Culture.
Is it?
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Producer Daryl is pretty hard line on this.
I see.
But we'll negotiate. So our three topics this week will be: topic number one is the right age for fandom. Topic number two is sensory overload and cowardice, question mark. And finally, topic number three will be post-truth 2.0. And so, Lynn, the right age for being a fan.
Yeah, so I've recently I watched two movies that have come out. One is Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. The other is Moana. And both are kind of for me and kind of not for me, because they're both sort of children / young adult movies. And in the case of Fantastic Beasts, it's a fandom from when I was the right age, when I was 12 or whatever, and reading Harry Potter. And so there is an element of, while watching Moana, I was just thinking, I love this so much. I love it so much, and I wish that I were 10. And I couldn't get over that. And I was just curious about what it is that makes for that right age. Is there a right age, you know, to be a fan, to fall in love with something for the first time? Because I think there might be.
Yeah. I'm sure there is. But can I just, Fantastic Beasts, did you enjoy it?
I did. I enjoyed both very much.
And you went to the cinema?
I did.
So when you were at the cinema with Fantastic Beasts, if you looked around the audience, were they all people like your age who'd read Harry Potter?
No, there were some highly inappropriate babies who got very, very scared. Like, as in, they shouldn't have been there. In both cases, actually, the movies were somewhat interrupted by crying children. So there, again, wrong age. You know,
wrong age. But when I watched Fantastic Beasts, lots of grown-ups. There were lots of grown-ups. There were lots of women in the audience who had grown up reading Harry Potter and would squeal behind me whenever a reference or an allusion was made to the series, which I really enjoyed because I love watching movies with people like that who get all the inside jokes and stuff. And it was such a nice experience in the cinema. But you're right about the age for fandom. And I think part of it stems from our initial reaction of not having seen anything like that ever before. And it somehow attacks a part of our brain, whether it's science fiction or fantasy or animation or fairy tale, that just blows us away. And I don't know if as adults we will have that same reaction. I don't know if anything, we're so jaded, we've experienced so much, whether something can still come along and go, ha-ha!
I felt like Moana offered that little window into my childhood brain. You know, there was a part of it that was so joyous that I was just like, this is what it would have been like if I were younger. But at the same time, I got all the inside jokes. You know, when Maui lifts his eyebrow like Dwayne The Rock Johnson, I'm like, yeah, I know what that's about. You know, when Lin-Manuel Miranda writes really complex raps in the middle of what is ostensibly a children's song, I get that. So there are layers. I'm not saying that there aren't entry points. I just wish I had a 10-year-old's entry point, and I don't. I never will have it again.
You never will, but you've grown up. You've matured. You have other things that you can enjoy.
Well, sure.
But come on, you can enjoy adult things.
No, but the point is also that you can still enjoy these things because you have the ability to switch on that child brain. A lot of people don't. A lot of people grow up and will watch Moana or Fantastic Beasts and be so jaded going, oh, well, you know, it's all so derivative and la-di-da-di-da, right? So I think our ability to switch on a certain part of our brain when you watch Star Wars or Transformers or whatever is possibly a good thing.
Yeah, and also because if you struggle too hard to keep it, then you'll end up being like Michael Jackson.
Straight to Michael Jackson.
Well, I'm sorry, what else is there?
I know, but that is a low blow for somebody stuck on David Bowie for years and decades. But
when are you leaving? Can't be soon enough.
It had to be done. You attack me, I attack you. But no, I mean, I'm just I was just thinking about, you know, I know I've been going on about Hamilton in real life and on this show now for what feels like an age. But similarly, I do wish that I were younger. I wish that I were young enough to learn the choreography unironically. You know, without, just as I'm able to switch on the childlike part of my brain, I can't always shut off the ironic part of my brain.
No,
and there is a part
Hamilton
that goes,
is designed for people your age. If you were 15, you wouldn't understand what the hell it's about.
What he said was, you know, I love the idea that somewhere out there in America is, you know, a high school girl rapping Angelica Schuyler's rap and knowing that that's the hardest one in the whole show. It's designed for theatre nerds. It's designed for musical geeks. And those people are born in school.
But also that there's some 15-year-old out there who will see a person of colour play Hamilton and that be the single image of the president embedded into their brain, right?
Three presidents.
Which is
three
also
black presidents.
Three black presidents, which is also incredibly cool.
Yeah. You mentioned David Bowie in oh, may wow. I say an insulting way, producer Daryl, can we, yeah? But you know, I came across him at my early teens.
A formative age.
Yeah. And it was a perfect time, and it does frighten me to think that if I hadn't found him then, if I'd come across him, say, at the age of 25 or 30, I wouldn't be able to experience the fandom.
Right, so which brings me to the question, Lynn, have you recommended stuff to people that you came across at a particularly young age and recommended to people now who are in their 30s or late 20s, and have they gone, well, what are you talking about, Lynn? This is awful. I mean, has
well,
that happened
Star
to you?
Wars.
It's happened to me quite a few times.
I think Star Wars falls into that category, the original Star Wars, because people are like, well, what are the effects? I don't understand this. Why does everyone lose their minds over Yoda? He's annoying. You know, whereas people, you know, who watched it at the right age, quote unquote, you know, you get that he's so funny and charming and wise, you know, and there are all these different things. But also, I remember that since we're doing a farewell tour of sorts, I remember that one of my very first times on A Bit of Culture was me talking about my love of Elvis. And I was in love with Elvis at the age of 10. And I think that that is the right time, you know. Any older and people would have been like, why are you weird? You know, I don't understand. And it was the right time to be bowled over by the pure charm and charisma of a man like Elvis without getting disenchanted with his later peanut butter bacon years.
Yeah, well, that's all good then. I mean, you know, you found these people. If it hadn't been Elvis, it would have been someone else, Lynn.
I know, but what about me now, Ken? That is
you'll
what
never,
I'm worried
you'll
about.
You'll never have that again.
No,
you'll never be able to see these things for the first time.
I know, but I disagree. I think you can. Look at Hamilton. Hamilton's a great example of that. I think
that's right.
We can all be obsessed with Hamilton because it's brilliant. It triggers a part of our brain. We know about Alexander Hamilton. We've read all these books about him. We've seen TV shows. But yet this thing comes along, this musical, this rap, this brilliant adaptation. And it blows us away, I think, in the same way that we would be blown away by The Little Mermaid or Lion King.
And Lynn, you're like a teenager again, aren't you? When you
a little bit. Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yeah, so these things will
BFF,
come along
I heart him
once
forever.
In a blue moon. Once in a blue moon. I mean, you can't get a new David Bowie every day because there's only one David Bowie. Don't say anything then. We move along. So, topic number two, sensory overload. You know, there are people out there who are hard of hearing, but they don't like wearing hearing aids because we, people who can hear properly, have the ability to hear sounds but prioritize which one we will concentrate on. Whereas if you have a hearing aid, you hear everything all at the same time.
Yeah.
And they especially don't like being in a noisy place because you can't just concentrate on the person who's talking to you. You hear the people on the next table, the music that's coming out of the speakers. It's an auditory overload. Auditory, is that a word? And I wonder now in this internet age if we, or certainly myself, are experiencing sensory information overload. Because my body was conditioned for a different age where I got news on TV twice a day.
Yes.
In the newspapers, if I could be bothered to read them. I went and bought a shortwave radio so I could listen to the BBC World Service. But if the weather was wrong, I wouldn't be able to hear it. But now with the internet, with Facebook, it's just all the time. At the same moment, I'm experiencing Syria, Rohingya, Brexit, Trump, the state of Malaysian politics. I mean, that's enough to be getting along with itself. And it just comes at you all at the same moment. And it's just so overwhelming. So I've come across a policy which is just ignore everything, cut myself off.
Switch off.
But I am now worried, is that cowardice? Should I be bold enough to face the horror and somehow be strong enough to deal with it?
What is your switching off? How do you define that?
Well, I've pretty much abandoned Facebook. I mean, I quickly look through just to see that everyone's alive. But I don't, investigate those stories about Syria anymore because it's just so horrifying. I mean, it's bad. I can't do anything. It's just awful. So I've been ignoring the news. I don't watch TV news. I look at the headlines once a day, but that's it. Actually, I'm kind of doing the news and information as I did in the early 90s, pre-internet.
Does that make you feel better?
Yes.
Okay. Because I think if it does...
in a word...
Very much better.
No, because I think if it makes you feel better, then who cares if it's cowardice? I think that, you know, cowardice is just another way you're trying to guilt trip yourself back into Syria. And I don't think you necessarily need to.
I agree.
I think being an informed person is, on balance, a good thing. But how you choose to seek out that information is entirely up to you. And I think everybody's threshold of how much information they want to take is really up to them.
Yeah. And it's a quantity issue, right? So I'm not one who necessarily buys into this whole idea of the bubbles being a new thing. We've always lived in bubbles. Now we classify them because we curate whatever we have on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or whatever, but it's always been the case. I mean, if you lived in America, the UK, or the decision of newspaper you bought meant that you were in that bubble. The channel you tuned into to get that news meant that you were in a bubble. Now it just means which channel we go through on the internet to read our news. So the bubble thing isn't new, and I don't think that's necessarily a new problem to solve, but the quantity of information is definitely a new problem to solve. Now, we have specific issues with that because, unfortunately, we are in the media and we feel that we have to be informed at all times because to come and do a bit of culture, you need to be, you know, have your finger on the pulse. But
the pulse of 1973.
But at the same time, I think when it begins affecting your sanity and well-being, because I genuinely find myself certain mornings where I'm like, I really don't want to go to work today. And it's not because I'm not enjoying work, but it's because if I roll over and look at my phone and all of those updates that have come on, you know, the push updates that have come on from your news feeds, they're genuinely depressing.
Yeah. And a friend of mine put it very nice, neatly, that you know, Malaysian politics is toxic. It's filled with toxins.
I think most world news actually at this point in time is kind of toxic. I think everyone goes on and on about how 2016 has been sort of a banner year for terribleness. And I think it's rare, right, that happens where everybody agrees, my goodness, 2016, we'll be glad to see the back of you. And that's partly because of this sort of overload that you're experiencing. It's just too much. People are dropping like flies. Wars are raging on. Politics is ugly. Donald Trump is president. I mean, it's just not a pretty sight. I don't blame you for wanting to look away. I wish I could. I'm not kind of there with you, but I support you in this endeavor.
You said, I mean, does it make me feel better? And we live in this kind of like, you know, feelings age. And I wonder if, okay, maybe it makes me feel better. But at the same time, if I'm not open to feeling the horrors of the Malaysian political landscape, then it's cowardice and it's unpatriotic and it's, I mean, not that I ever really can achieve anything. I can't do much.
Do you
about
think
it.
You're a good person and a good neighbor?
No, but yeah, I mean, Hitler would have said yes. Anyone would say
he was a good vegetarian.
Yeah.
That was about it.
But you can't help yourself when it comes to feeling a certain way about whatever. I mean, Malaysian politics, yeah, it's close to home. It's who you are. It's your family. It's everything, right? Because these are our brothers and sisters. But at the same time, you're a human being. So you're going to feel as strongly about people dying in Syria or anywhere in the world. Genocide is going to affect you. I don't think you can switch yourself off to that just because you've stopped reading the news. I mean, if it's not in your face every day, then maybe, yes, you're not going to be thinking about it all the time. It's not going to be immediately depressing, but it doesn't mean you care any less. I don't think that's the case.
I also think there are different ways to engage with society at large other than knowing news and feeling helpless. Because, I mean, you're saying, like, if I'm getting it right, I think what you're implying is that, look, I feel better, but why is it so important to feel better when I could be feeling more responsible, you know, as in understanding things, knowing things. But I think there are other ways to engage with the world. You know, you don't necessarily have to know all the horror to know that you might want to do good in your immediate environment. You might want to volunteer. You might want to recycle. You might want to, you know, be nice to somebody one day.
Yeah, we'll just take a nap. Can I just do that?
You can just take a nap.
You can do that and emerge, you know, a bit of culture host because you've rested. I mean, there are all these different ways to engage.
But can I just very briefly, before we move on, return us to the original premise. Is the internet, though, just simply amplifying the same quantity of news as there ever has been? Is it like having a hearing aid in a noisy restaurant?
It is, because in the past you've always had curators that'll tell you what's important. Now you don't. Everyone's a curator. So you may get a small story coming out of a small village somewhere because someone living in that village posted it on Facebook. It went viral. It's a tragic, traumatic story that affects you in a big way. In the past, that may not have been picked up by the New Straits Times or the Guardian or the New York Times, whatever you were reading at the time.
And is 2016 any more horrifying than, say, I don't know, 1966?
Yes.
It is.
Well, no, I mean, it's just been a tough year, yeah. Cam Roslan.
Well,
I don't know.
Any year that David Bowie dies is
going to be a tough year.
You're right. I'm glad you've moved on.
The toughest year.
Yes. Okay, in a moment, though, topic number three with Uma here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with me, Cam Ruslan, Uma Pagan, Ampike Pagan, and Lee Tree Lynn for her very last A Bit of Culture.
Is it, though?
Is it, though?
Is it?
Yeah, she's begging.
She likes teasing us this way.
Yeah. Okay. Uma, Post-Truth 2.0.
Yes, Post-Truth 2.0. I think we're calling it 2.0 because Lynn discussed it a few weeks ago.
2 weeks ago, yeah.
But also, it doesn't mean that I have any new ideas about it, by the way. No, but I came across, I was having dinner and I met someone who was a friend of a friend, and I had this argument with this individual. And he was hell-bent and convinced that this post-truth world is one that we can profit from, or that he can profit from, because that is how business politics will work from now on, that facts no longer matter, that if you want to get elected into office or if you want to be successful in business, this is what you have to do. This is how you peddle your wares and your information so people will be on your side and get the votes you want or the money you want, right? I gave up talking to this individual after a while, but it followed on from a conversation I was having with A.C. Grayling, who was he's a professor of philosophy, and he was down for the Georgetown Literary Festival. And he gave me some very scary information. He said that during Brexit, it was a conscious political strategy to lie to people. And they would manipulate the media in that way. And the BBC, when he met with the editors of the BBC, they had a genuine problem. And the problem was this. The Brexit people would release lies and misinformation late at night, and the BBC would run it in their morning shows where everyone was listening. By the time the fact checkers came in and the truth came out, no one cared because the people, their target market, believed those lies already. Heck, I heard it on the BBC. It must be true. And the truth didn't get out there. So everyone went into the voting booths with this information or misinformation. Nigel Farage then was an advisor to the Donald Trump campaign, and apparently he advised Trump the exact same thing. It doesn't matter what you say, as long as you say it loud to the people who will have a knee-jerk reaction to believe you, and you can do whatever you want. No one will care about your past, your dealings with women, whatever. This knee-jerk reaction, which is kind of hardwired into our brain because a lot of us are short-term thinkers, right? We only want what is immediately good for us. They're not stupid or bigoted or racist. No, you're just immediately thinking about yourself, and that appeals to that short-term thinking. And so you go into a polling booth with this. This frightened the heck out of me. Like, over the last 2 weeks when I've been having these discussions, I was like, how do you even fight this? Where do you counter this? If people are not amenable to the truth or facts, where do you even begin? And that's what I wanted to ask you two, who are clever people.
Oh, I thought you were about to tell us the answer.
I do not have the answer. I mean, everyone I've spoken to, and I asked A.C. Grayling, like one of the smartest men on the planet, and what he had to say was, oh, you know, we have to educate people, start them from young and at school. I'm like, it's too late for that.
It's like Pizzagate. I mean,
oh my God,
it's
Pizzagate.
Exactly like Pizzagate. Are you familiar with Pizzagate?
I've not been watching the news.
Congratulations.
Well done, Cam Roslan.
You know, one of the world's most horrifying stories. You know, it's just, it ended up with a shooter kind of entering a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. because he was convinced that the pizza parlor had participated in a child sex ring involving the Clintons and, you know, a bunch of other people. And this was something that was perpetuated
by the Trump people.
By the Trump people, but based on nothing.
A particular pizza parlor.
Yes, I forget the name of it now, but right. It's called Pizzagate. If you were to suddenly decide to re-engage and Google that, you'd find it. But yeah, and it was, you know, one of those horrifying stories. And even the other day, in response to last week's Bit of Culture when we talked about nasty women, somebody texted in to say Hillary Rodham Clinton is a pedophile. So you see, even in Malaysia...
A Malaysian sent that?
Well, I mean, it was via text. So one has to presume so.
This is also based on all the false news that have been going around. And of course, everyone knows it's false news, right? It's been proven false. Even the false news people, the people who create the news have come out and said, hey, we're just doing it to make money. It's all fake. but it gets out there.
I think the point that I was trying to make in Post-Truth 1.0 on A Bit of Culture was that I, much as I hate the suggestion, I'm wondering if we need to sexify truth. Or is that not possible? Because truth is truth, and it is what it is. And the people who are interested in truth are always going to be interested in saying, well, this is how it is, children, and lay out points A to Z. You know, as opposed to doing it Daily Mail style. Like, if the editor-in-chief of Daily Mail wasn't such a repulsive person, you know, you would want him as a consultant to say, look, we have this headline. It is absolutely true. How do we make this interesting?
Well, I mean, populism has worked off lies and disinformation forever. That's what populism is. And it has been for centuries a very enticing product.
But I think you could have a populist truth teller. I think that person could exist.
I think the very fact that it is a lie, people know that it's, because it's so beyond the truth as it is understood. I mean, people have always been telling you, we cannot get unemployment down below a certain point. We cannot make everybody rich. And if somebody comes along and says,
We can,
then that's exciting because it breaks boring normality.
No, but this goes back to what you were saying, Cam, about the just previously about the spread of information, or in this case, wrong information and false information. One of the stories that was doing the rounds on my Facebook feed, and I'm sure you all saw it, just before the elections, was this fact of, I say fact, sorry, was this story about an FBI agent who apparently was involved in the leaks of the Clinton emails, who was found dead. And if you read the story, and I clicked through because I found it fascinating, and you read the story, and it feels like a piece of theater. It's everything's there, but everything is made up. Even the town in which he was supposedly killed was made up. Mm. And yet, there were people I know who feel, I used to think, were bright, educated people sharing these stories on the Facebook feed going, oh my God, did you know this?
Well, I think if there is a bright side that I have noticed, and I think I mentioned it already on Bit of Culture, that my Facebook feed was filled with these fake stories.
Right.
And people I know saying, look at this, you know, Hillary Clinton's not just a paedophile, she flew one of the planes during 9/11. And the day after Trump won, they all stopped. They all stopped posting this rubbish. I think they realized, maybe we went too far. It was just a joke.
Maybe what we're underestimating is the pure appeal of gossip. Mm. Because it's one thing to have a knee-jerk emotional reaction to something, but it's quite another to kind of give in and indulge in that very human need to sit down and go, do you know what she did? And, you know, right, to kind of gossip about it. And I think that's how these stories kind of get spread. It's not just that, you know, did you know that she's a pedophile? It's also, oh my God, did you know she's a pedophile? It's a totally different tone.
It is a different tone, but the reason this frightened me so much, and we'll bring it back home, is that a lot of these strategies, and I don't know if they're consciously being applied in the Malaysian context, but they are. A lot of these strategies are being used here as well. Oh, Maria Chin is CIA, she's a spy. You know, this information gets spread across all of our local political discourse as well, against people that maybe those in authority dislike. And that information gets shared over WhatsApp, and it gets out there. And oftentimes what I feel is, in Malaysia, there's not enough of a counter voice to that. And that's why I say I don't know where to begin when you want to talk about truth. I like your suggestion of sexifying truth, because I know it sounds cheesy, but man, maybe that's the way.
I think that Obama had that opportunity at the very beginning of his presidency to sexify the truth, because he had this enormous wave of popularity and you know,
hope. And just sheer oratory skill.
Yeah, and hopey changey stuff, and they were with him. But like day one, he was boring. He went straight to being very boring, because he wanted to be stable and dull, but he could have gone off and opened factories and built new power stations and whatnot.
See, I think...
And people would have gone with that.
So I was just having a discussion earlier about Duterte with somebody who used to support him and who has now started to get a little bit disillusioned.
But
a Filipino who voted. But who at the same time is doubling down on, no, but the war on drugs is still a good thing. And I'm like, no, it isn't. In just so many provable instances, it is not. But I think that, and the thing that I keep coming back to in that argument is, your president should not be condoning the deaths of 20,000 to 30,000 Filipinos. Like, that's a great...
Isn't that many?
That's what he's saying. You can expect many. Hmm. You know, if you want to call me Hitler, go ahead.
Extrajudicial killings, just
it's fine.
All over the place.
Right now, it's not that high, but he's saying it could get that high, and he's perfectly fine with it. He says, and that's what you get when you have a sexified leader. I don't think our leaders should be sexified. When I say we should have a truth teller who's a little bit sensationalist, who's a little bit gossipy, I don't mean President Obama.
No, I know who you mean. You mean Neil deGrasse Tyson. You mean someone like that who can take science and make it fun and popular and sexy and sell it.
And not afraid to troll and to argue.
Correct.
That's very important. You have to engage and go like, well, idiots.
Well, John Oliver then. You mean a John Oliver?
Yeah, right? Something
I love
like
John
that.
Oliver. But he's preaching to the choir as well. So somebody who is not yet around, who is not going to necessarily appeal to either side of the fence, who's going to be able to come up and go like, hi, everybody, you know you're all being stupid.
I think the person who's actually being lined up for that job is Michael Moore in America. Because he is that, he has that, the blue collar credentials.
He does.
But at the same time, he's been steadfastly anti-Trump and he's been liberal all these years, but he's always maintained that sort of non-Hollywood persona.
He's also the one person who, one of few people who also said Trump's going to win.
Who predicted it successfully.
So maybe him. And maybe we need someone like Michael Moore, but less annoying here in Malaysia.
Well, I have been thinking, but my policy is to think, is to play the very long game. You know, democracy makes us fall into four-year plans because that's when the next elections will always be. And also always to think in terms of majoritist politics because democracy needs to just win the most number of votes. But I'm not in the business of winning votes. But if I can create work that, is persuasive and is fun and entertaining in the long term, then that would be my goal.
I think you're right. I think that's the way, right? If we can't sexify the truth and reach as many people as possible, then maybe the way is to do what you're doing and try to at least reach one person.
Which is really good because I think I'm pretty sure by looking at the numbers of our Facebook page that
we have at least one listener.
We have one person. So we've succeeded.
Your legacy, Cam. Your legacy is secure.
Well, before we lose that one person, we should move on to the final part of the show, recommendations, where we recommend something that we think might be of interest. And Lynn is going to go first for the last time.
Is it, though? okay, well, Moana, obviously, really great,
yes.
Really wonderful, a true feminist Disney cartoon for the eight. I just loved it. It was wonderful.
Are you feeling shiny, Lynn?
I love that song.
I love that song.
So, such a good movie. Go watch it. The other thing is just an app that I've discovered recently that I introduced to producer Daryl as well, actually, called Radio. I think it's got four O's, five O's. Well, just look for it. It's Radio with multiple O's at the back. And what it does is it allows you to pick a spot on the globe and then pick a decade and then pick a tempo and it'll play music from that time. So you could go 1970s Indonesia, you could go 1980s Somalia, you could go, you know, and it'll just go with wherever you want. If it's not available within that decade, it'll be grayed out. But the point is, you could be anywhere. You could be 1990s Zambia, you know, and just like kind of rock it out.
So you could do like 1973 South London.
More like 1970s England, and you get a bit of, you might get your friend, or, you know.
David Bowie, say
sure,
his name.
Sure, but you may also get, I don't know, Donovan, I'm not sure. But it's cool. A mix.
Radio.
Malaysia 1960s is lots of fun. Cool. I'm sure I don't need to tell people that. But the point is it exists, and that's kind of cool.
Music overload. It's me next, isn't it? My recommendation is a brand new film. About 5 years ago.
Cutting edge.
which we mentioned before. I watched it the other day, and it's like, I just don't think it got enough love in its day when it first came out. And that is Super 8.
I love that movie.
It's a really good film. And I think it really speaks to your topic for this week, Lynn, which is, you know, fandom at the right age. And you're watching in Super 8. It's a story, J.J. Abrams, and it's pure Spielberg 1980s. A bunch of kids
on bikes
making a movie, aliens, the government, you know, it's got everything. And but you're watching them as you were then, experiencing everything for the first time, first love, adventure. It's great fun, but I don't it didn't exactly disappear without a trace, but it didn't really
land.
Land.
No, and for that reason alone, a lot of people just felt it was too steeped in nostalgia. Meanwhile, those are the kind of movies we grew up watching, Goonies, Gremlins, all of that stuff. And it's weird because Stranger Things, the Netflix show, seems to have recaptured some of that nostalgia.
It's all nostalgia, Stranger Things.
Exactly. Yeah. And maybe 2016 was where we needed to be to get into that again because maybe. The year was so horrific.
Yeah, maybe. So that's the movie Super 8. It's just great fun.
I'm going to go watch that again, actually. I haven't seen it in years.
Yeah, and great performances by the kids in it. Really good performances. So, Uma.
I've got two recommendations. My first one, because we are mere days away from Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, I was going to recommend Carrie Fisher's new book called The Princess Diarist. And essentially, she had discovered some of the diaries she wrote during the filming of Star Wars. And the big scandal that came out, obviously something we all probably already knew, was the fact that she was having a rip-roaring affair with Harrison Ford at the time. But ignore that. It's actually a really well put together book, and I'm really enjoying reading it because it's a glimpse into not just her life in the 70s, because we've heard of her, we've at least heard about her life after that, the drugs, the alcohol, all of that stuff. But this is the story of this 18/19-year-old girl shooting what was to be one of the greatest film franchises in the world. And it's a really well written, well put together book, and I'm really enjoying it. I'm about halfway through now.
She's a smart cookie.
Carrie Fisher is very smart and incredibly funny.
Yeah,
so funny. And if this is indeed completely unedited diaries, she was funny all the way back then too. She's really, really sharp and smart and such a good read.
What are they called?
It's called The Princess Diarist.
Okay.
D-I-A-R-I-S-T.
Right.
And it's available here. And actually, I think it's on. Oh no, it's not. I lie. It was the Hamill tome. Which is now on 30% discount at Kinokuniya, which is very cool. But my second recommendation is, because this is Lynn's farewell tour, I recommend that all of you go listen to Too Long Should Listen. Too Long Should Read, Lynn's show on Bigger Picture, which is a fantastic show, but she stopped doing it now because she's leaving us. But yes, it is a great bedtime listening. That is not as creepy as it sounds, but it's very good.
It'll be archived in radio.
One of these days.
Or, on BFM.my or our app. Download our app.
Okay, so that brings us neatly to the end of this week's episode. Only remains for me to thank Uma Pargan and PK Pargan.
Thank you, Cam.
And to thank for her invaluable service over all these years, and to wish her good luck in her new chosen profession, Lee Chui Lin.
Thank you.
Going to miss you. And okay, all right, we'll have producer Daryl.
Just throw me a bone every once in a while. Yeah.
She'll miss us.
Yeah, we'll let her back in. And myself, Cam Rustin. Speaking of me, I am taking a break, British culture, for a few weeks on a traditional New Year's break.
How dare you?
Are we, Cam? Really? No one told me.
Yeah,
I'm just going to be sitting here by myself.
No, what we have something planned, which is we're going to play over the next few weeks the best of 2016, that wonderful year that has been 2016, where we will discuss things like, for instance, The Death of David Bowie, old episodes which we think were particularly good.
Don't pick that one, Daryl. It'll be funny.
No! Don't listen to her. She doesn't work here anymore. And please get in touch with us on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page, the likes upon which shot up, I think it was like 400%. 400%. Every vote counts, people. Really. Two people looked at it. 400% rise. And also, we're across the media. Uma is still Mr. Twitter King.
I'm on at Uma Pagan.
Uh-huh. Lynn, are you...
I'm not on Twitter anymore, but I'm on Instagram at Schmurls. I'm on Snapchat at Tweezles.
Okay.
Just all over the place.
Schmurls and Tweezles.
I know. Tweezles is kind of a funny pun. Tweezles.
You should trademark those. You can make some snacks or something.
I know. I know.
And, anyway. So, folks, please join us, next week and in a few weeks' time, here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9.
Save big at Banana Republic Factory with 60% off the entire store. Our biggest sale of the year. Plus, take an extra 50% off clearance. Stock up on dresses, shirts, and shorts under $15. Find your nearest store or shop online only at Banana Republic Factory.